From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. The Silver State's economy is showing signs of distress. That's according to the latest outlook from UNLV's Center for Business and Economic Research. The 2025 report details a series of troubling declines. Everything from gaming revenue, visitation numbers, occupancy rates, and airport traffic is down from where it was in early 2024. Despite that mounting uncertainty, the report says the economy remains relatively stable. While the average consumer may be staying away from Las Vegas, major events and consistent casino wins are helping keep the worst of a possible recession at bay. Here to help us better understand that analysis is Andrew Woods. He's the director for the Center for Business and Economic Research at UNLV. Andrew, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me.
It seems like we've been talking about a sluggish economy here in Nevada for the last couple of years. I know it was a major issue here on the campaign trail in 2024. What's going on?
Sure. Well, I'm happy to do my best to understand what's going on in the world of economics. It is my favorite topic and topic we're always researching and working on at UNLV. So right now, we think that the U.S. economy as a whole is still growing, but it is uneven in different ways, and that has causing some stress here in Nevada and some kind of dueling narratives that we see in the economy, which is really causing some concern, but also at the same time providing some stability for our economy and some confidence heading into next year that things are stabilizing. But the word I'm using is I'm also cautiously pessimistic about the long term or not the short term growth over the next year too as well. Given that, and why is that? One is the labor market. It does appear to be kind of frozen at the U.S. level. In Nevada specifically, it depends on what part of the state you're in. So up north in Reno, there's still growth in healthcare jobs, professional and business service jobs, some warehousing jobs. But construction is way down. Same here in southern Nevada. Construction jobs net year to date through August are also down. We do forecast that the unemployment rate will rise a bit in 2026, but we're not forecasting a recession either. What's kind of continuing to pull the economy along at the same time is we do see investment, particularly in healthcare and information technology, a little bit of manufacturing. And we do see that the Strip and Vegas in general for visitations and visitors, we do think is stabilizing around here in southern Nevada, between 39 and 40 million visitors a year, statewide, somewhere around 50 million. And we think that number isn't, we don't forecast it right now to be a plummet much further, but that provides some stability of kind of we're in a lower growth cycle, but the bottom isn't falling out. We're not calling for a recession, but certainly slower growth heading into 2026.
A lot has been made of this year's slowdown in tourism. Overall, visitor counts were down by 7% for the first half of the year. The latest numbers from the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority show another 4.4% decline in October. Those numbers don't concern you?
So if you got to break it down, though. So why we're getting the year-over-year declines is international visitors, particularly from Canada, continues to impact visitations to the state and southern Nevada. Nevada is the fourth most popular state for Canadians to visit in the United States. And they do account for the largest portion of international visitations to Nevada. And we're down right now roughly 20% rounded from year-over-year. The second one is we are soft on the domestic visitation, weekend warrior type visitations, especially coming from Southern California. Now, some of that might be on the affordability and the national economy narrative, but at the same time, when I look at numbers in Orlando or Honolulu or San Diego, they don't seem to be having the same issue with domestic visitation. So it makes me wonder if there's a narrative out there about our pricing strategy and the $20 bottle of water and the $30 martinis and the $50 parking and how our operators are adjusting to the consumer who might be pushing back or feels that there's concerns about value. What gives me optimism is that convention business seems to have been pretty steady. Even in October, right, we're only down 0.1% year to date, roughly. That basically we're even. We're even with where we were last year on business and convention travel. And if businesses are still investing in bringing their workers to Vegas to have a convention and meet with clients and interact within their industries, that to me is a sign of confidence within business spending that, you know, we're heading into 2026. They're still investing in some ways in growing their own business. And that's a good sign for Nevada and the convention business heading into 2026, which seems to be kind of buoying and counteracting some of this. The last thing I'll say, too, on the visitations is there is this K-shaped economy that we see in different places in the economy, which is basically that the upper echelon of the income bracket, so top 10%, top 5%, top 1%, however you want to slice and dice it, seems to still be steadily spending, while as it's the 90%, you know, the middle and lower income brackets, their budgets are a lot more struggling given that affordability continues to be a concern. But we see that in Vegas. For example, private jet travel to Vegas is pretty on even with it was last year. If you had bought Wynn stock at the beginning of the year, you would be about 70% richer right now in that stock, while other casino stocks may have struggled and not kept up as much. And I think that just goes to show that there are different consumer segments out there, and some are doing fine and are fine paying the $30 cocktail and are coming to Vegas, which is good for our economy. But there are other parts that are pushing back on, again, maybe how we've sold this pricing strategy behind our visitors.
That's Andrew Woods with UNLV Center for Business and Economic Research. We're talking about the organization's economic outlook for 2026 and beyond. Of course, it's not just Vegas that's seen a decline in tourism. Reno Sparks also saw a dip in visitors over the summer. With us for the Northern Nevada's perspective is Brian Bonifant. He's the project manager for the Center for Regional Studies within Nevada Small Business Development Center. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Paul.
What's going on in Northern Nevada? It's a different economy there, not quite as dependent on tourism as Southern Nevada. The Tahoe-Reno Industrial Center has brought a lot of manufacturing and industrial jobs or logistics jobs to the region. There are agricultural and mining opportunities in rural Nevada. From your perspective, is that economy faring any better than Southern Nevada?
Yes, it is. And especially when you look at the spending side and the taxable sales, you're seeing fiscal 25, Clark County was flat, 0% growth. But if you look across the state, it was a 2% growth. So that's the first time we have ever seen Clark not carry the state ever in spending in 2025. Washoe County growth was 4%. So what we're seeing is this new post-global economy shaping in Nevada, across Nevada, with the EV, the renewables, data centers, logistics, rare earth. So we're starting to really kind of see the state be diversified, and so not as reliant on that tourism and hospitality that shapes up Las Vegas.
As someone who's looking at the numbers, talking to the businesses, talking to the industry, developers, you know, what are you hearing from them?
We're tall on fear and short on facts. So there's just a lot of echo chamber of doom and gloom out there. And then when you get into the, you know, when you look at the survey data that comes out, you know, on a monthly basis, very recent, consumer sentiment, you know, this is all heavy surveyed, and we're really struggling with surveys. The margin of error on surveys has gone way, way up. And so the empirical data, the primary data that really gives you the pulse on the economy is very lagging. That's a 6-month lag. So we really like just to look at the empirical data to really shape the where the economy is going. And if you look at all those metrics within that primary data, it's all, you know, increasing at a decreasing rate. And so we're hearing a lot of fear. You know, the builders are still 65, 70% of what they're doing in 22. Housing is going to be an issue moving forward. That's our big issue. But outside of that, you know, gaming, when spending, employment, unemployment rates, we're all in a good area with those.
Why is housing such an issue?
Well, it's the mortgage rates at 7%. Gotcha. And then 15 years of not building supply. And those two issues have come together and Elliot really have crimped us. So we've really, you know, we made a lot of strides. We continue to make a lot of strides on the rental side of the market with bringing in supply. We're starting to see the rents kind of flatten, more vacancies, which is good news, of course, for the affordability. You know, now we're running a percent of your income for housing costs is, you know, above 30%, which is not healthy. So if we can get those rents to flatten and come down below that 30%, that'd be good. But the home ownership side is going to continue to struggle at 7% mortgage rates. We're at 6.3 right now. If we get into a 5.5s, that would really spark a lot of activity in the home ownership. However, federal debt is really going to put you know, an upward pressure on the mortgage rates to continue to hold those above 6%. So really, it's the federal debt that we need to take care of for that mortgage rates to come down.
Andrew, if you talk to consumers, their confidence is shaky at best. 1 in 5 say that the economy is good. So when should consumers start worrying about a recession?
When you see companies start laying off and unemployment rates start really going up. You've seen some softening here at the end of the year. We got ADP numbers this morning that showed that private sector payrolls decreased about 40,000 jobs. You know, we'll get the federal government data soon. I think consumers so far, as long as they are employed, are still spending money. We still saw record spending during Black Friday. We still are our concerns about debt, but it seems like access to debt like credit cards and whatnot are accessible for people. And it's also because they're able to pay those because they have a job. So I think we're watching that labor market. You see the Fed watching the labor market. You see professional economists talking more and more. And now Wall Street talking about where the labor market is and where it's headed into the new year.
Brian, just real quickly, you know, the state was hard hit by the recession in 2008. Has the state done enough to maybe limit the impacts of that again?
Certainly up north. I mean, it's, you know, we're uniquely positioned in Nevada to take advantage of this 21st century post-global economy of data centers, R&D, space opportunities. So I think we're doing a really good job. That diversification, you know, GoEd's done really well with that. So, yeah, I think I'm really bullish on our state of economy.
We're going to have to leave it there. Andrew, Brian, thank you so much. This is State of Nevada. We've all been there, and some of us might be dealing with it right now. It starts with a scratchy throat, more fatigue than usual, or maybe even a little bit of congestion. And before you know it, you're calling out of work or school sick. That's because it's respiratory disease season. In fact, stats show that the next 2 weeks are historically when flu and RSV hospitalizations peak in Las Vegas. That's according to Southern Nevada Health District's new respiratory disease dashboard, which launched in mid-November. Along with hospitalization rates, it also tracks fatality numbers and vaccine uptake. Here to discuss the dashboard is Benjamin Ashroff. He's an epidemiologist with the health district. Benjamin, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here and be able to talk about this new tool.
Excellent. So the health district has said that this dashboard is not just for healthcare providers, but also regular community members. So what do people like me get out of a database like this?
So that's a great question. And I think the one thing that it is, it gives you a perspective of what's going on in your community. At times it's hard, sometimes it's hard to find the data. So that was our goal when designing this. We wanted to bring the data together for three different diseases in one place where you can track the information. As a regular individual, you can see like how many hospitalizations are going on in the community. Is the vaccine uptake high or low, depending on the disease? And is there a lot of individuals going to the emergency room? And with that information, you can make more of an informed decision on whether you should go and get vaccinated, see your healthcare provider, or maybe do some, you know, precautionary measures, such as like washing your hands or potentially even wearing a mask if you so desire.
What about healthcare providers? Don't they already have this information? How can they use this?
So for healthcare providers, again, I will go back to that it's a streamlined, transparent way collected in one source. Again, information tends to be sometimes siloed. It's one of the unfortunate aspects about healthcare information. So with that, we're able to bring it together in one location. And we do this from a variety of different sources. We bring in emergency room data from federal resources. We bring our vaccination data from state resources. And then we're able to show locally what's going on as far as hospitalizations. So we're bringing together, I think the idea of bringing everything and putting it in a nice one location where someone can observe is really beneficial for the community.
Like I mentioned at the top, the dashboard's data suggests that we're going to see RSV and flu peak within the next few weeks, but it'll probably be a while before we see another large spike in COVID, which usually happens between midsummer and late fall. So why is there a seasonal difference between an illness that seems pretty similar?
So that's a great question. And a lot of this deals with, just different peaks, different unique aspects of the viruses themselves. Usually in the fall, you see this aspect when people are getting more enclosed areas together, such as kids are coming back to school. And then, obviously, and people are being, within certain locations where you have close contact. Now, COVID is a little bit unique. We have been consistently seeing there's peaks in the summer as well as the winter. And that could be due to certain aspects of the virus, as well as like potential travel that may happen during the summer as well. During the summer, people tend to travel more and may be able to come into contact with this.
Data also shows that the COVID fatality rate has dropped something around 98% since the height of the disease in 2021, excuse me. But though we don't have consistently high COVID hospitalization rates anymore, we are continuing to see large multiple-month surges. Why would the virus be settling into a rise and fall pattern?
So that's a great question. The one part that I would like to see is that, we have new variants. COVID constantly evolves. And then with that, there comes unique challenges. However, as far as the mortality statistics, a lot of individuals have been immunized or exposed to the virus at some point since the onset of the pandemic. So they do have a degree of immunity, which may give them some protection from having more severe outcomes of the disease.
Switching gears and talking about the flu again, the American Lung Association said last year's flu season was among the most severe one it's seen in over a decade. Looking at the dashboard's data, that doesn't seem to have fully been the case for Southern Nevada, which saw about the same number of flu hospitalizations as the season before that. Why might the Las Vegas area not reflect the trends in the rest of the country?
Well, at the moment, that could be due to a couple different reasons, such as the varying vaccination rates between communities and also potential contact within communities. I will be glad to, look a little bit more into that and provide some more information if you so desire.
Well, we'll just move on to the next question. National health agencies have already observed that this flu season is also shaping to be particularly severe. Is that increased severity something the health district has seen local evidence of so far?
At the moment, we have seen seen hospitalizations starting to increase over time, and we're consistently monitoring the data to see potential increases in hospitalizations and mortality data on a weekly basis. And so we are constantly tracking that.
What's the absolute latest that someone can get their shots and still be protected from the holiday flu and RSV peaks?
Usually we say the vaccine is recommended around the September-October time period to allow your body to produce the antibodies needed for protection. So, however, I would still recommend vaccination as soon as you can if you still haven't gotten the vaccine. Definitely talk to your healthcare provider and if you're interested in getting vaccinated.
Benjamin Ashroff is a Southern Nevada Health District epidemiologist. Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time.
Lake Tahoe straddles Nevada and California, and like many areas across our vast region, it's home to both people and bears. Two bears, a mother and her cub, known as Hope and Bounce, are wanted for breaking into homes. Wildlife officials want to euthanize the mother. For the Mountain West News Bureau, Maria Palmer, with our sister station KUNR in Reno, has this story about the effort to save the bear.
She's not happy.
A crowd gathers under a pine tree in the backyard of a home in the Tahoe Keys neighborhood. All eyes are looking up. High in the branches, overlooking boat slips and the lake, sits a black bear and her cub.
Did you hear her huffing?
That's Kathy Zollinger. She's a member of the Bear League, a volunteer-led nonprofit that educates people on how to live alongside the bears. The league runs a hotline that residents can call when they spot a bear in their neighborhood or their homes or anywhere that's too close for comfort.
Bear and a cub were trying to get into somebody's home, scratching, I think, at the back door. And a homeowner called us, that homeowner over there, and told us that a bear was trying to get in. So we got here as quick as we could.
The goal isn't to hurt the bear, but to scare it back into the forest. But when a bear is up in the tree, all you can do is sit and wait.
We just step back and wait for them to come down, and then we'll try and haze them out of the neighborhood.
And we waited for 2 hours. That's when Zollinger told me about the bears keeping her up at night. Hope and her cub Bounce. For the past 3 years, Hope has been breaking into homes around the Tahoe Keys. Bounce was born this past winter and has been following her mother's lead. The Bear League has been tracking them through neighborhoods, watching, warning, trying to protect them. But that mission is now at odds with the state of California.
This is a bear we have a long history with. Just this summer alone, she's broken into more than a dozen homes.
Peter Tira is a spokesperson for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. He says after years of trying to change Hope's behavior, the agency has decided she must be euthanized.
Some of those are opportunistic entries. Some of those are forced entries, broken windows, things like that. Tens of thousands of dollars of property damage.
Tira explains that bears go after human food because it's high in calories and easy to get. California is home to about 60,000 black bears. And in South Lake Tahoe, as people keep building deeper into bear territory, these encounters are only increasing. That's why Hope has been approved to be euthanized.
If we have the opportunity to safely and humanely capture the bear and euthanize the bear, we will.
As for the cub, Bounce, Tira says the department plans to keep him alive and rehabilitate him.
Up in the tree. Yep. Yeah, a mom and a cub.
Back in the Tahoe Keys, longtime resident Brady Hodge bikes up to where we're sitting.
Not the same mom and cub everybody knows. It's a different mom and cub.
Hodge has lived in the neighborhood for 50 years, and he remembers the time a bear broke into his house after he left a window open with trash inside. He called the Bear League for help.
And they were out right away. They were very responsive.
Sometimes the league tries to scare the bears away. But more often, Zollinger says, they educate residents about how to live safely alongside them. Things like keeping windows and doors closed, using bear-proof trash cans, and even installing electric fencing.
And if you can't do that, you're not giving them a fair shake.
Hodge believes longtime Tahoe residents have learned to coexist with the bears. But when he found out that Hope was on the list to be euthanized.
I'm totally against what they're proposing. That makes no sense. They're beautiful animals and they're fun to watch and they will not hurt you.
After nearly 2 hours, the mama bear slides down and jumps on their nearby fence. The cub follows but is afraid and looks back at us. The cub follows his mama out of the backyard, and Kathy Zollinger's job is done for today. She's still on the search for Hope and Bounce and wants to keep them alive. For KUNR Public Radio, I'm Maria Palma.
Since their inaugural season in 2017, the Las Vegas Golden Knights have started nearly every season as serious Stanley Cup contenders, and the 2025-26 season is no different. But nearly 2 months into the season, the Golden Knights are on shaky ice. They're currently 12-6-8, meaning they have more ties and losses than wins. Danny Webster is the Golden Knights reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Danny, it's a pleasure to have you back on State of Nevada.
Appreciate you having me.
12-6-8, that sounds like a middling record, but they're currently second in the Pacific Division. It's still pretty early in the season. So how is the team looking so far?
Well, you know, injuries are playing a big factor in this. Their captain, Mark Stone, was out for 16 games. He's just now come back to the lineup. They're down William Karlsson, their top center. Their top goaltender, Aiden Hill, is also out for what we perceive to be at least through Christmas, probably a little bit more. So they've had to rely on a lot of young guys coming in. Braden Bowman, who was a call-up from Henderson, who's really in his second year of pro hockey. He's gotten off to a great start. Cole Reinhardt, who they've entrusted on the fourth line, has played very well as well. And now they are bringing in a new goaltender in Carter Hart, who has not played in the National Hockey League in 2 years. So the fact that they're being able to stay afloat and play as well as they are is really remarkable at this point.
You mentioned Carter Hart, so let's go ahead and just jump into that. He made his first appearance on the ice yesterday. As you mentioned, since early 2024, the game was also his first appearance as a Golden Knight. There's a lot to unpack on this guy's story, so help me out. Who is Carter Hart?
Yeah, so Carter Hart was a second-round pick back in 2016 by the Philadelphia Flyers, touted to be a very promising prospect at the time. In 2018, he was playing with Team Canada in the World Junior Championships, the annual tournament for players who were 20 and younger. And there was an incident in June of 2018 during a gala to celebrate Canada's gold medal victory, in which Carter Hart was one of five players that were accused of sexually assaulting a woman in a hotel in London, Ontario. The case did not come to light until Hart and the four other players were charged in 2024. And at that time, the NHL decided that the best course of action would be for them to take an indefinite leave of absence. The five players were acquitted in July. And in October, the Golden Knights brought in Carter Hart on a professional tryout deal. The players were eligible to join teams on October 15th. On October 16th, he joined on the PTO, and the Golden Knights signed him to a two-year, $4 million contract 8 days later. And he was eligible to play on Monday. All five players are now eligible to play in the NHL as of Monday. And they are underway in the Carter Hart era and got his first win last night.
And how has he been received by fans?
A lot of mixed reaction. A lot of fans who've reached out to me are very pleased to see him getting a chance. They fully believe that because he was acquitted, that he did nothing wrong, and they feel that he should be given a second chance. A lot of other people on the other side of the aisle are definitely opposed to this. Just looking at my mentions on Twitter this morning, a lot of people are not very happy that he is getting this opportunity. A lot of people feel that he has not been remorseful in terms of just the victim herself, just the overall encompassing of sexual assault charges. There's a lot to unpack there with that. But it's definitely a mixed reaction. There were a lot of fans who had some signs last night at the game voicing their support for Carter Hart. I believe there maybe have been one or two that were kind of opposed to it in terms of bringing signs. But overall, definitely it is a mixed reaction among fans, and I would say probably even split right now.
Right now, the Knights are second in the Pacific Division, right behind the Anaheim Ducks. They've played the Ducks twice already this season. They lost both of those games. Are the Ducks the team to beat this year?
It's tough to say. I mean, the Ducks are definitely exceeding expectations. A lot of teams in the Pacific are exceeding expectations right now. The Ducks are definitely one of them. They're a very young team. They are built around a young core. They brought in some veterans to help guide them along the way. And, of course, their new coach, Joel Quenneville, coming over as Stanley Cup winning coach to help lead that new era in Anaheim. So I would say give it maybe another month to see if they can sustain it. But the Pacific Division in totality is definitely much improved from where it was last year. So it's not just the Golden Knights and the Edmonton Oilers and the Los Angeles Kings now running away with it.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but during team captain Mark Stone's absence, the team went 6-10. Was that a fluke or was that a symptom of Stone's absence?
I think it was definitely a symptom of his absence. When Mark Stone was in the lineup, the first six games of the season, the Golden Knights' power play was one of the best in the league, and they were operating at a near 40% clip. When he went down, I believe, if I remember correctly, the power play went 3 of 34 in his absence, and they had to make some changes along the way. They brought up Braden Bowman from Henderson, a 22-year-old who has definitely impressed in the organization. They brought him in as kind of like a mini Mark Stone clone a little bit to at least alleviate pressure on the power play. And he came in and he scored again last night. He's been a real good revelation for that team. But now that Mark Stone's back, he had an assist last night. He scored a point in every single game. Right now, he is definitely their MVP in terms of on and off the ice because they missed him. And now that he's back in the lineup, the Golden Knights seem to be getting back on track.
30 seconds left. What are you going to be watching as the season progresses?
Just to see if they can stay afloat through these injuries. Like I said, William Karlsson being out definitely hurts them down the middle. Aiden Hill, we don't know how long he's going to be out. Can Carter Hart carry that workload going forward? It's going to be very interesting to see how that progresses. But this team has won before. They have been able to battle back through injuries before, so this is not going to be any exception.
Danny Webster covers the Las Vegas Golden Knights for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Danny, looking forward to having you back soon.
Awesome. Appreciate you having me.
There's a great quote about books as gifts by cult director, author John Waters, but we probably shouldn't say that one on air. You can look it up. The point is, when in doubt about what to get someone, books make great gifts. And for Nevadans, books about the state or by its authors are even better. Over the past 4 months, a slew of such titles have been released. They've hailed from many different genres, novels, memoirs, essay collections, even books about the environment. Helping us sift the wheat from the chaff is KNPR's Mike Privat. He sat down with Scott Dickensheets, editor-at-large at Desert Companion, Nevada Public Radio's City Regional Magazine, and a known bibliophile of regional renown.
Scott, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Always happy to show up and talk about books.
Thanks for being here. Scott, just to start the conversation off, what is the best book that you've ever received as a gift?
Well, this is going back a ways, Mike, but when I was in second or third grade, my mom got me for Christmas my first ever Hardy Boys novel. You know, it's sort of like a gateway to young boys who want to read. And so I spent the next years of my life sitting on the couch instead of going outside and riding my bike, much to my mom's chagrin to some degree. But yes, that was the book that sort of, I don't remember which title, but that was the book that sort of opened up these vistas for me.
And how do books figure into your holiday shopping nowadays? Do your family members even bother giving you their Christmas lists?
Well, I don't actually buy a lot of books for my family. They have their own reading habits, and I'm not privy to them sometimes. They order a lot on Kindle. But how books figure in Christmas for me and my family is that everybody in my family, my friends, my acquaintances, Facebook friends, all know that the only thing I ever want for Christmas is bookstore gift cards. Hopefully from the writer's block, but in a pinch, Barnes & Noble will do. It's kind of a running joke in our family now that, you know, this year's tally or whatever. So books figure big in our Christmas in that sense.
So let's get to the task at hand here, recommending Nevada interest books for those who are stumped out there on gift ideas. And let's start with the one that came out back in August by John M. Gliana. He's a part-time Las Vegas resident and writer who's covered the American Southwest extensively as a Los Angeles Times reporter and bureau chief. And his new book is called Rebels and Outliers, Real Stories of the American West. Sounds like a follow-up to his 2022 book, Outback Nevada, Real Stories of the Silver State. Scott, why should we be reading John's work?
Well, John has a real knack for going out into the middle of nowhere and finding the stories that want to be told, that need to be told. He finds the right people. He's super curious, and he's a very garrulous guy, so he can get people talking. And piece by piece, books like this in his previous book sort of flesh out your sense of what the West is, and the kind of people who live there, and the kind of people you didn't think would live there, and are prospering or not prospering. And so he has a very wide-ranging curiosity and intelligence, and of course, he's a pretty vivid writer. And Mike, here's a good reason to give Gliana's book as a gift. All the pieces are fairly short, and they're vivid and entertaining, and so once the wrapping is done flying through the air on Christmas morning, and you're in the holiday doldrums for the rest of the day, you can sort of snack on these pieces as the whim hits you, and you'll work your way through a fair number of them.
Las Vegas and New York bar entrepreneur P. Moss has had a pretty notable second career as an author who, shall we say, likes to detail the seedier side of life. And his seventh book, Screwing Sinatra, came out in September. Now, full disclosure, you gave him some guidance on this book before it was published, so you're probably the best person to ask what on earth is a book with that title about?
Well, I gave him a proofread is what I did. So I didn't give him editorial guidance. He doesn't need my help. if you know Moss at all, his books are typically crime fiction crossed with alternative history. He loves certain previous eras of Las Vegas, and he loves to rethink them from the inside out. And so Screwing Sinatra is about how, you know, the chairman of the board, Old Blue Eyes, gets crosswise with not only, you know, the mob as embodied by Sam Giancana, but also the Camelot as embodied by JFK and RFK, who are, it's not a spoiler to say, the bad guys. It's a wild romp, but also, you know, one of the things that Moss really does, much like Carl Hiaasen in Miami, is sort of underline just all the different ways human corruption and venality and greed flow through the history of this town. And so, and they're tremendously entertaining, but you have to be of a certain sort of a hardy mindset to read these.
So what you're saying is I should absolutely buy Screwing Sinatra for my Sinatra-loving mother.
That depends on how elastic your mother's sense of humor and propriety is. But there's some, you know, pretty off-the-wall stuff in there. Par for the course for Moss. This is by far not his most out-there book. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of out there. So be warned, but also you'll be entertained.
Another novel comes to us by H. Lee Barnes, a well-known former Las Vegas-based author who has since decamped to Northern Arizona. As the author of 10 books, he's a member of the Nevada Writers Hall of Fame. Scott, why is he there?
Well, he's written a number of books that deal with Las Vegas. For example, his novel, The Lucky, which deals with downtown Las Vegas, and his book, Cold Deck, which deals with the secret societies behind gambling and gaming and so on. But also, he's done some nonfiction work, too. His book, Dummy Up and Deal, which took you to the inside the lives of casino dealers and table dealers and so on. He's got serious Nevada and Las Vegas cred.
His latest book, Emerald City Blues, is actually set in Southern California. It sounds like he's as interested in these American West characters as John Gliana is. Do I have that right?
Yeah, absolutely. This book is set in World War II era, mid-World War II. The protagonist is a woman who comes down from small-town Pacific Northwest to Los Angeles to be part of the war effort, to do what she can. And she finds camaraderie and whatnot amongst the other women on the doing these industrial jobs. But she also gets mixed up in the blues scene, which then brings in, you know, the era's racial tensions. These are not stock characters. These are like actual sorts of people, Westerners living the lived reality of the West in those years.
Now, here's one for all the conservation wonks, professional or armchair. The book is called Environmental Change in the Lake Tahoe Basin, a synthesis of science and public policy. That's just out by the University of Nevada Press. I suspect there's a specific person for whom that gift would be the right fit. And how would you describe them?
If you have a nature wonk or a policy wonk on your gift-giving list, this might be a book for them. We can all agree, I think, that Lake Tahoe is beautiful, it's magical, it's by any stretch, it's a national treasure. And because of the way America treats national treasures, of course, it's been subject to, you know, logging and mining and growth and tourism, lots of complicated social and business forces, and there's been pollution issues. And so this book is kind of a case study on what has and hasn't worked in trying to manage all of those different forces for the sustainability of the lake itself. And while it may seem like it has a small audience, it's kind of good to know because it's all about reasonable, science-based public policy. And at a time when reason, science, and public policy are all sort of under fire in one way or another, it's good to know that books like this are out there sort of holding the torch against all the forces that would sort of frack Lake Tahoe for all of its resources.
Now, another Nevada publisher, Huntington Press, they recently released the 16th edition of the Las Vegas Rights series. That's an annual collection in which Nevada authors opine on a specific local theme. This year's title was Monsoon Season, Las Vegas Writers on Water in the Desert. Scott, you were a participating writer this year. You've been a former editor of other titles in this series. What ultimately are the selections in this book about?
That's a good question, Mike. As you know, water is not only a vital, but also a very versatile force here in the desert. And it has a lot of metaphorical overtones. It has a lot of like engineering and science overtones, quality of life overtones. So all of that is fair game for some of the stories that take place here. And you have a wide gamut of writers. Like you have John L. Smith, sort of the dean of Las Vegas journalism, writing a memoir of his childhood in Henderson. And then at the other end, you have Jeff Schumacher writing a history of water use in Las Vegas, which I don't want to make that sound dry because it's just chock full of really interesting facts and eye-popping figures about how much water our predecessors in this valley wasted and their sort of blind faith in the inevitable refilling of all the aquifers. My contribution was about tears in the desert in the wake of my wife's recent death. And so I wrote about water as a vehicle for tears, as a vehicle for grief and reconciliation with the desert.
Finally, we have an intriguing title over here. It's called No Overnight Parking, A Year of Van Life, Discovery, and the Open Road by local public relations professional Jürgen Barbuska. That book is out this week, and the title suggests that this could be an ideal book gift for a wide range of readers. Does the title accurately depict what the book is about?
Yeah, it does, Mike, in the sense that it depicts a sort of restlessness and continuing motion. Jürgen spent a long time out on the road doing this sort of van life thing that seems like it'd be one of my dreams, to sort of just spend a lot of time wandering with no schedule, no deadline, no set itinerary. If he saw an interesting sign, he turned. If he saw something, you know, on the map that seemed curious, he made a beeline. And so, you know, he found his way up to Canada. He found himself in rural America, all over the place, checking out all kinds of things, staying overnight in Walmart parking lots or wherever he could pull over. Part of it happened, I think, during COVID as well. So that's another layer of the things that he observes in the America he was traveling through. And it's a really interesting way to sort of get a ground level feel for the country as it is and as it was shaping up during the time of his adventure.
And we'll have links to where you can purchase all of those titles at knpr.org. Scott Dingenschietz is an out and proud book lover and the editor at large for KNPR's Desert Companion. Scott, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mike.
There is no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options is KNPR producer Mike Pravat, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
Okay, Thanksgiving is over. It's time to dig into the holiday entertainment. What you got?
Well, nothing says 2025 Christmas like a triple dose of Ebenezer Scrooge. That is what the UNLV Performing Arts Center and College of Fine Arts are delivering this week in Las Vegas, while the Reno Little Theater has the North covered. And yes, we're talking about A Christmas Carol. First, over at Artemis Ham Hall at UNLV, Las Vegas' Bunker Dance Center is taking a swing at the Charles Dickens classic.
Are we talking about a dance in Dickens?
Kind of. There is some rebranding going on, though, as the show on the ticket actually reads A Spirited Christmas Carol. And the lead character is not Scrooge, but a guy named Clint Briggs. The concept remains the same from there. Clint's heart is not in the right place. It's affecting the lives of other people. And so three ghosts will visit to help put him on a path towards redemption. And that's on Saturday, December 6th at 2 and 6 p.m. Now, for those who want a little more of a dramatic take on the story, Nevada Conservatory Theater's A Christmas Carol 1941 is currently playing at UNLV's Judy Bailey Theater through December 14th.
Why 1941?
NCT Executive Director Kirsten Brandt was on our program earlier this year, and she said then that she wanted to present this 19th century story with a more modern context, especially given the parallels of what we're seeing with business and labor right now. However, by using post-Pearl Harbor America, the production gets sort of a jazz-era glow-up, which means music, courtesy of UNLV's award-winning jazz program, which, by the way, is also finishing up their yearly jazz festival this week. And also, there's a dance component here, too, thanks to UNLV's dance department.
You said Reno has a production as well. Does it have dancing?
Well, that's a little unclear. The promotional art for their Christmas Carol does advertise music, comedy, visual effects, and audience participation. So this is no straight play. It also has gender-blind casting for its three-person adaptation, including actor Judy Davis Rounds playing Scrooge in both of the two casts being used. Yes, that's three people for every character per performance. So there should be a lot of energy on stage, even if there's no dancing. And that one is at Reno Little Theater, also through December 14th.
Okay, what if I'm feeling a little overwhelmed by all the Christmas talk and want something a little bit more, I don't know, grounded? Is there anything like that going on this time of year?
Well, Paul, the Writer's Block and Black Mountain Institute have you covered twice. On Friday, December 5th, two well-known Vegas-based writers and former BMI fellows will converse about the book Baby Driver, the 1981 autobiographical novel written by Jan Kerouac, the only child of beat writer Jack Kerouac. Now, why are they talking about a book that's 44 years old? Well, part-time local Amanda Fortini has written a new introduction for the newly reissued book.
And who's the other writer joining Amanda?
That's Taja Eisen. The two of them are going to talk about the long out-of-print book, which the New York Times just called possibly this year's most important literary salvage mission. Taja and Amanda will cover Jan Kerouac's tumultuous upbringing in early adulthood, her lack of a relationship with her father, and I would imagine also her take on independence and a life in constant motion.
When I said give me something more grounded, you heard me and you did not disappoint. I appreciate it. All right, you mentioned two Writer's Block events. What's the second one?
On Saturday, December 6th, Los Angeles author Max Delson will touch down in Las Vegas and join UNLV associate professor and acclaimed novelist Miley Chapman for another book chat. Max just published a collection of short stories called Crawl. It's about 2010's Seattle, seen through and experienced by its transmasculine characters. And Crawl sounds like a must read. It's getting a lot of praise for being funny and titillating and original. And Max will read from it during the conversation with Miley. So a very grown-up doubleheader for you at the Writer's Block this weekend.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thanks, Paul.